Case number 21-1718, Kenneth Allen versus Hanover Insurance Group Incorporated. Oral argument is not to exceed 15 minutes per side. Mr. Keel, you may proceed for the appellant.
Yeah, and I'm Alvin Keel. I'm appearing on behalf of Mr. Kenneth Allen. I'm from Lathrop Village, Michigan, in this matter. This case, briefly, and I'd like to reserve a five-minute rebuttal.
Very well.
This case involves a accident occurred on September 26, 2016. My client was a passenger in a vehicle receiving serious injuries. As pertinent to the case before the court, the driver had a policy of 100-300 with AAA. The insured passenger, which was my client, Mr. Allen, he had a coverage as a resident insured under a policy with his mother where he resided.
Didn't he deny residency at one point?
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear you, Your Honor.
Wasn't residency denied at one point?
No, not initially. Let me explain it to court. What happened initially, this was a two-pronged policy situation. The initial case involved PIP benefits, which was ultimately litigated in the Wayne County Circuit Court. But with respect to the PIP benefits, they were paid voluntarily. There was two examinations under oath of Mr. Allen and his mother. There were two various depositions, and it was decided that Mr. Allen was covered as a resident family member. He was a co-owner of the property in question. So, answer your question, was he a resident? Yes. How do we know? Because he was paid pursuant to the policy for 18 months under the same clause which the defendant intends to rely upon now. And the section that I'm making reference to specifically is the liability coverages. In this case, Hanover had a $1 million coverage under the underinsured provision, but it's still under the same liability provision as set forth of the PIP. You can't bifurcate a policy. So what I'm saying to the court is this, is that once it was decided that Mr. Allen was in fact a resident insured, no question on earth he was, and no question that they decided because they paid him for 18 months.
Didn't he make a statement or his lawyer made a statement at some point that he was not a resident?
He made a statement, Your Honor, saying that it was an interesting statement. His statement specifically says, and that was earlier on, prior to the determination by the PIP carrier that he, in fact, was a resident. The statement was to the effect that I reside somewhere in a lot of different places. I have a residence with my mom. I have residence with various other people.
Well, residency is a legal.
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear you.
Residency is a legal definition, doesn't it?
Yeah, and his.
I mean, it's not just where you happen to hang your hat on a particular day.
No, and he specifically stated his permanent residence was, in fact, the residence with his mother. And it was agreed to. How do we know? Because they paid the claim, Your Honor. They agreed to it. Hanover said, I agree with you, and we're going to pay you a PIP claim. Same argument was residency established with respect to PIP. It comes under the same policy. And they said, we agree. They, in fact, notified AAA that we are the party responsible for coverage for Mr. Allen. In writing, they said it. They then paid for 18 straight months. They discontinued payment. Then at that time, litigation was initiated in the Wayne County Circuit Court. After it was initiated, it was settled. They paid the balance of Mr. Allen's PIP claims during the pendency of this litigation. And they also stated that he had coverage for the continued coverage after the case was concluded.
Well, you know, Hanover Insurance Company is claiming that you sought benefits from Hanover under the mother's insurance by claiming that you had a settlement offer from AAA. And you had to obtain that offer from AAA before you went to Hanover. But Hanover says that was a misrepresentation contained in your letter of January 22nd, 2019, because at that time the statement was untrue that you did not have an offer from AAA. And one of the issues around which I guess the lawsuit revolves is whether you engaged in fraud, because the Hanover policy exempts coverage of a party who engages in fraud. Well, what do you say about all that?
I say that would be poppycock, Your Honor, if I may state affirmatively that the letter was submitted in January 22nd, 2019. When I say the letter simply stated as settlement negotiation privileged under Rule 408, and it said clearly, at the conclusion of the request for the payment of $1 million and also for the request of the consent, rather, of Hanover with respect to the approval of the $100,000 tentative settlement. We know the settlement happened. How do I know it was correct? It was correct at the time the statement was made. It became ultimately officially correct on April, I think it was the 7th of 2021, when the parties agreed to it. Was the $100,000 paid? Yes, it was. It was paid just like it was stated in the letter. It was tentative at the time, and it did not constitute a material misrepresentation.
Well, but the you didn't have the offer at the time you sent the January 22nd letter. That's the problem, isn't it?
No, not really. It was a tentative offer. You don't have to have an offer. It wasn't a misrepresentation. It was a tentative offer. And it was made at the time that we have an offer. And then I think
let me ask you this. Did you submit in connection with this litigation and in connection with the motion for summary judgment, did you submit any statement from anybody from AAA stating that your version of the events was true and accurate in connection with the motion for summary judgment?
Attempted to, Your Honor. I submitted verification that the settlement discussions took place, and I submitted a request to AAA at the time, and the request was for a formal offer. But, see,
but did AAA provide you with any statement or anything stating that they had agreed to pay the $100,000 as of January 22nd?
No, not at that time, Your Honor. But see, I think the court, when I say there's another approach to this, and I think the court is, I don't want to say not following it, but what happened? This, anytime you have settlement negotiations, they're protected as privileged under Rule 408. And it was a correspondence sent.
Well, that's not relevant here. You were writing to Hanover, saying, providing them with representations that you had a settlement with AAA. So nothing about confidentiality of settlement negotiations is relevant for this point.
Well, I tend to disagree, Anna, because it is very relevant. What happened is this: at the time that the letter was sent, it was a settlement. Negotiation is the rule. And was it a negotiation? Sure, it was a negotiation. The negotiation obviously can't be used for the proof or disprove a claim, and that's all that's attempting to happen here. And see, but the whole issue, and if you get a little bit further along, is when the complaint was filed in this matter back in 2017, there was an answer timely filed with affirmative defenses. Defendant failed to list as an affirmative defense fraud. Fraud should have been waived.
Well, no, because they didn't have the information at that time to know that fraud had been committed or allegedly or ostensibly committed. They couldn't allege it at that time because they didn't have the information. So
that's not
I guess their argument is that they alleged fraud as soon as they came into possession of information indicating that there had been fraud.
Well, that's not exactly correct, Your Honor. They came into possession of the letter of January the 22nd, 2019, on January the 20th, on January of 2019. How do I know? They responded by sending correspondence back, and they sent back a settlement negotiation back and forth saying, if you do these things here, we may be able to waive subrogation and resolve the case. See, so they argued that they had notice. They didn't get noticed of the fact until May of 28th of 2020 is just simply not true. If so, it's negligence. How could a person be in litigation for over 2 years and not have notice of a letter that initiated the litigation? And then come to the court and say, oh, by the way, I'm claiming, I didn't file my affirmative defense because I didn't know about it. I didn't know about it, but a letter that was sent to my client on January, but I didn't know about it until 2 years later? That's not true. That's invalid.
All right. You'll have your rebuttal time.
Good morning, Your Honors. Rick Patterson appearing on behalf of Defendant Hanover. Judge, you asked the initial question of whether or not he denied the residency. In fact, he did. It's not critical to the determination here today, but I just wanted to, he did fill out an affidavit after the accident indicating that he hasn't lived at the address for the policy since 1997. So that, I think that's what Your Honor was referring to as far as him living someplace else. The issue here really is, you know, the plaintiff committed fraud because in January of 2019, he sends a letter indicating he has this offer from AAA for $100,000, and oh, by the way, now you need to pay me the $1 million under insurance that's on this policy that my mom got. In order, and the reason they state that is because the triggering event or the prerequisite for being entitled to underinsured coverage is that you've exhausted the underlying policy, which would be the $100,000 policy here. And the fraud came out, it was discovered, and this gets into the not pleading the affirmative defense of fraud initially, in May of 2020, the parties entered into, they were having some discovery disputes, and they entered into stipulation of certain facts, and this is from May 28, 2020. And in that stipulation, the parties agreed that on January 22, 2019, and at the time that the letter correspondence attached was sent to defendant Hanover, plaintiff did not have an offer from AAA. That's the false statement here. That's the fraud. They made a representation in January 2019 that, you know, they had this settlement offer from AAA. We find out 15 months later in the course of discovery in this case that no, in fact, they never had that offer and that they lied when they said that they did. So that is the at point in time that Hanover discovered fraud had been committed. And that's, you know, shortly thereafter that they moved to amend the affirmative defense, and the court allowed that. And counsel's indicated, he seemed to argue that our position is we never received that letter. That's never been our position. Obviously, we got the letter. We responded to it in February. But the distinction is we never knew that the letter was a lie until the stipulation was entered in May of 2020. And at that point in time, that's when we motioned the court for the ability to file a second summary judgment motion because we had discovered the fraud, and we asked them to amend the affirmative defenses. In going through the elements of fraud, clearly, as a prerequisite for coverage, the statement that they had the settlement offer was material to how Hanover addressed the situation. They then started their own investigation on whether or not these underinsurance benefits would be payable. So they relied on that statement. Obviously, I just talked about the fact that it was false. And, you know, by acknowledging in that stipulation that they never had an offer from AAA, plaintiff had also admitted that they knew the statement they were making in that letter was false. So, and obviously the defense incurred expenses in defending this litigation that it otherwise would not. So all of the elements of fraud have been satisfied. And I did not hear anything from plaintiff's counsel in his presentation that would refute any of the elements that fraud was established here and that the court properly granted summary disposition on that claim, or summary judgment as to plaintiff's claims on the basis of fraud. Now, the plaintiff's counsel also raised the issue of 408. Judge Clay, you correctly identified that this is not everything that you say is a settlement negotiation is otherwise protected from any further use. If it's used for another purpose, the rule specifically says that's appropriate. Here, obviously, it's being used to establish that a fraud was committed on the defendant in an effort to gather benefits. I mean, it's pretty clear that plaintiff in this case has done anything and everything he can to try to collect benefits related to this accident. He made the representation initially that he didn't live with his mother so that he could collect PIP benefits from AAA. Then once he found out that he might be able to get benefits through his mom's policy, he switched course and said, well, no, that was my domicile. I'm entitled to PIP benefits, and those were paid. But the prerequisite for the other aspect of that, the underinsured policy, that didn't ever kick in because he didn't exhaust the AAA policy prior to making a claim for that. And by the time that claim was ripe for underinsured benefits, that claim had been dismissed because of the fraud that was committed by the plaintiff. Now, the other aspects that were raised in the motion or raised on appeal, I just want to touch on briefly. The idea that, first, plaintiff claims that the issue of allowing the defendant to amend their affirmative defenses and also denying plaintiff the ability to refile another summary judgment motion are reviewed de novo. Those are not. Those are reviewed for abuse of discretion. Those are discretionary decisions by the district court. The plaintiff has presented absolutely nothing in this case to establish an abuse of discretion by the trial court. As I mentioned previously, the defendant's ability to amend the affirmative defense to include fraud was appropriate based on the timing of when they learned the fraud had been committed. With regards to the plaintiff filing a second summary judgment motion, the district court pointed out and highlighted that the plaintiff failed to properly follow the local rules to request such a motion. Then they did nothing for 11 months, and there was no good cause to allow the plaintiff to file another summary judgment motion at that time. Plaintiff has identified nothing either in briefing and didn't even mention it here today in oral argument to establish that there was an abuse of discretion by the district court judge in determining that there was no good cause to allow him to file a second summary judgment motion. So I know there's time left, but I think I've addressed the issues. If your honors have any questions. Thank you.
No, not. Thank you. In a rebuttal?
Yes.
With respect to filing a second summary disposition motion, there was no summary disposition motion ever granted or allowed to be filed by the trial court. The court abused its discretion in that regard. The court allowed an amendment of its pleadings by a motion for reconsideration approximately a year and a half later after the motion was filed. After the complaint was filed, he allowed the defendant to add the account of fraud after the course of discovery had concluded, allowed no additional discovery, making it virtually impossible to respond to the incident of alleged fraud.
What would you have needed to respond?
What I need to respond? Yes, I would have certainly responded by showing that no fraud was committed. And at the time that interestingly enough, Judge, at the time that the motion was in fact granted, the case had already been settled. This case was actually settled in April of 2021. All these motions took place after April of 2021. It was submitted to the court and asked for his approval. He wouldn't give it to it.
What settlement are you referring to? A AAA or
yes,
a Hanover?
The AAA. It was actually settled on April the 7th of 2021. The case
that's
for
$1 million.
No, $100,000. That was the $100,000 for the driver, and the million was for underinsured motorist provision. The case was settled, so it almost was moot at the time that the judge made his ruling. However, now this is important to note: at the time that the judge held the case, he denied the motion to enforce settlement on two different occasions. Why is that important? Because if the motion was granted to enforce settlement, the case would have concluded with respect to AAA. Wouldn't happen. The judge then simply goes on to say that the motion was improperly before the court. We filed it again. AAA and I attempted to agree to it in May. We attempted to agree in July. And he grants these additional motions.
All these events were subsequent to the alleged fraud. These are later events, aren't they?
No, they're before. No, he didn't make the allegation and reconsideration until after those dates. Oh, no. He didn't even get an opportunity to review his amendments pleading until after that day.
When I say they were subsequent, all these things happened after the letter that you wrote that allegedly was had fraudulent information.
Oh, you know, but see, you know, when you talk about fraud, not to be an academic scholar, I know there's six elements. In this case, the judge was summary disposition is based upon erroneous information and whether or not a jury could reasonably make an intelligent decision in favor of a non-moving party. There is no way on earth you could write under the sixth element, the fourth element, the fifth element, the plaintiff, in this case the defendant, relied upon the representation and, the word is and, the plaintiff therefore suffered harm. Suffered no harm. You can't even use the accumulation of attorney fees as harm. Harm has to be independently established.
Let me ask you this. Why did you send that letter saying that AAA had, or suggesting at least, agreed to $100,000, which was the policy limits under the AAA policy?
Because they had verbally. They had done so. They
really
had.
Well, no, I don't think so, because if they had, you would have gotten a statement from AAA to that effect in connection with the support your argument in connection with the summary judgment motion, but you weren't able to come up with anything like that.
Not totally correct, Your Honor. No, I contacted AAA. AAA said, yes, we will settle the case, but I need a resolution of the subrogation clause.
They will settle, which means they had not settled.
Of course, you settle as a finalization of act. Of course, it wouldn't settle until you signed the papers, but they had agreed to settlement, is what I said. And they had agreed to settle the case, Your Honor.
I thought it was only an adjuster that...
Who had the authority to do so? He had $100,000 responsibility. He did agree. And then what happened after that point in time, he said, I need some response with respect to subrogation. And the whole thing was about whether it's going to be subrogated. The case settled for the same $100,000. The issue was subrogation. How do we deal with Hanover in the issue of subrogation? But was it a negotiation? Sure, it was a negotiation. But, you know, I understand what the court's saying, but that's just totally incorrect. And there were further abuses, if I may briefly state. There were several abuses by the district court that led to this, would put Mr. Allen, who had a valid claim, at a disadvantageous position continuously, and to not allow a party to settle a case and then subsequently allow reconsideration of affirmative defense and give no additional discovery, no opportunity to file a motion. In this case, plaintiff had not one motion filed. And at the same time, allow the defendant to file two different motions for summary disposition. Something's wrong with this process, Your Honor. Something's wrong with it.
Thank you very much, and the case is submitted.